time, waiting for the time where I could start my retreat and not even looking at this wonderful opportunity. It wasn't until he had been there about 5 days that it finally sunk in. You are doing exactly what the Buddha said not to do. You are not being present. You are reacting instead of responding. And then it was, wow, what kind of Dharma teacher am I? Look at what you're doing. And then it reminded me of one of the talks that Ajahn Amaro gave, which I really appreciated. I listened to one of his talks on why he came to Buddhist practice. And he had studied with Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah is a great Thai meditation master. And Ajahn Chah had studied with Ajahn Mun. And the concentration that was mandatory in this particular lineage was incredible. People were achieving these, you know, just heightened states of consciousness, spent many, many, many months in solitary practice. And Ajahn Chah under Ajahn Mun also became very, very adept at solitary practice. But what he found out was, soon as he left his cave, his mountaintop, to quote Sartre, you find out hell is other people. And that's what he found out. He, Ajahn Amaro talked about it, and he said he couldn't believe how could he have these blissful, wonderful states, and as soon as he comes in contact with others, it all just blows up. It disappears. Practice goes out the window. I related completely. I was so glad that I had listened to this talk. So what Ajahn Chah did was he founded a monastery based on community. He thought it was equally as important to have a meditation practice as well as to be practicing the five precepts. Do you all know what the five precepts are? Anybody not know what the five precepts are? Okay. Okay, a couple of you. You know, we don't talk about this much in the outside world. Hopefully in our Buddhist practice we're talking about it a lot more. The Buddha said we need to start with virtuous action, ethical conduct. And it's simplified into the five training precepts. And the first one is, I will not harm or kill living beings. The second is, I will not take what is not freely given. The third is, I will not engage in sexual misconduct. The fourth is, I will not tell an untruth. And the fifth is, I will avoid intoxicants that lead to heedlessness. Well, Ajahn Chah, when he found the monastery, made this a cornerstone. He wanted his monks and nuns to practice these precepts. And he wanted the lay people that came in and supported the monks and nuns to practice these precepts too. So that's what he did. And the talk I listened to Ajahn Amaro, he made a very interesting comment. He said, the talk I listened to was after a 10-day silent retreat, and he was giving his final talk. And he said, you know, I think if you guys had just sat here in silence and practiced the five precepts, you would have accomplished just as much with all this meditation practice. He said just being in silence with the precepts is just, if not more, important. I was really surprised to hear that. But I think that would make sense coming from a teacher who put so much emphasis on community and getting along. So I'm going to go back a little bit into what Bhikkhu Anālayo talks about. And some of you have been practicing for a while. I have a question for you. What do you think is the preliminary practice that you need for practicing the Brahma Viharas? What do you need to do first? Anybody know? Okay, I'll tell you. First of all, you practice with the five precepts. And in Bhikkhu Anālaya's book, he goes into how important it is. How can you have a compassion, a benevolence practice, being happy with the joy of others, being equanimous, if you are not practicing ethically yourself? You can't. It's not possible. I've written a book, which I'm hoping will be published this year, and it's anecdotes from prison from inmates who practice with the five precepts. So for many inmates, this is all they can do. Sitting in silent concentration is sometimes almost an impossibility, but they can be mindful about how they are acting during the day. I was going to read this at the end, but I love this one so much. I'm going to just read you one anecdote. It's pretty short. And this particular young man gave me permission to use his name in exactly what happened. So I've changed the names in a lot of instances, but not at this one. So at a Central Valley prison in the fall of 2015, the evening's round table was, "What sort of kindness did you commit today?" And this has been a round table discussion in many of our prison sanghas. All but one inmate had performed a kind act, and that inmate was reminded of kindness he performed for a sangha member, but he forgot. In prison, there is little emphasis or even support for kind acts. Such an attitude can appear weak, and the inmate runs the risk of appearing to be an easy mark by both custody staff as well as other inmates. Sangha is one of the only places where compassion for others can be openly explored. Damien is a young, baby-faced, light-skinned, mixed-race inmate, and he took a big chance one morning when he practiced compassion for a custody staff person. Now, that's never done. You don't help out guards, ever. So here's what took place, to quote Damien. "I work in the kitchen, and we have to get there really early to prepare the meals for the day. So there was a bunch of us showing up, like at 3:30 a.m. The CO, custody officer, was collecting our IDs as we went into the kitchen. There were so many of us signing in that he was having trouble holding them all. He started juggling them to keep them from falling, but they all popped out of his hands and went all over the floor. Everyone started laughing and laughing, and he got so red and angry, I thought he was going to have a heart attack. I've never seen a white guy so red. I don't know why, but I decided to help him pick up all the cards. We were both down on the ground picking up the cards, and the other inmates were making fun of me. But I didn't care. I wanted to be kind, and I felt bad for the guy. We finished picking up the cards, and all of us went into the kitchen where I was made fun of some more. At the end of the shift, everyone tries to take food back to their cells. They put it down their shirt fronts. They put it in their underwear. The same CO is patting everyone down as we walk past him and taking all the food away everybody was trying to take back to their cells. Well, I had a lot of food on me, too. When it was time for me to get patted down, he just looks me in the eye and says, 'You're good.' Wow, instant karma." The whole sangha laughed and did high fives with Damien. He exhibited bravery due to his kindness, and the sangha loved it and loved seeing instant karma in action. So that doesn't normally happen, that instant karma, but in that case, I was really glad it did. So the precepts are what we practice first when we're going to be working with the Brahma Viharas, with the sublime states. Second are the hindrances. So we actually see, do we have greed going on? Do we want it different? Okay, I had greed going on. I wanted it different. I also had aversion going on because I didn't want it that way. You're not going to be able to practice the Brahma Viharas if you're pushing away. You're wanting more of something or pushing something away. And I certainly was doing that. The next is sloth and torpor. This is sloppiness of the mind and tiredness of the body. The next is restlessness and anxiety, concerned about the past and anxiety about the future. And the fifth is doubt. And then doing the Brahma Viharas, there's phrases. Bhikkhu Anālaya doesn't put much emphasis on this. He believes we should be doing radiating metta, actually feeling this loving kindness. I'm sure all of you have felt it. Sometimes something touched your heart and you actually felt it. You actually felt the heart opening. And this is what should be developed. Actually practicing this taking place and doing it over and over again, I think one of the most famous people to do this was Ram Dass, who said his practice was radiating metta, and he had a picture of George Bush on his puja table, and that's what he radiated metta towards. And he said when he finally could do that, he knew he was close to freedom. I guess that would be. I mean, you think about it, where you would see somebody like that and nothing comes up other than just kindness and wishing them well. And then each Brahma Vihara has a separate feeling tone to it, and actually deciphering what that is. I know when I practice with it, with metta, with benevolence, I just feel an opening in the heart center, you know, almost a warming. Sympathetic joy, which is considered by many to be the most challenging of the Brahma Viharas. I see Angela shaking her head, yes. This is the joy for the happiness of others. It sounds like that'd be pretty easy, wouldn't it? What if you went and you had a lottery ticket and you were off by one and your next door neighbor got it? And they had exactly the right number, except yours was one off. Would you feel just the same joy and happiness for them? Well, it's kind of difficult. Ayasantachitta likes to say, if you want to know how your practice is really doing, look at mudita, sympathetic joy for others. See how you're doing with that. That'll give you an inclination. And then Bhikkhu Anālaya says practice with each step separately, and eventually you should be able to just go from one to the other. This is what I had intended on doing on my retreat and practicing in this way. I got to practice with my son, and we got to know each other again. And I could have totally blown it because of what I thought I should be doing. So I had also a reflection, and like I said, this talk is all over the place. One of my reflections was, let me back up. The name of this book is Compassion and Emptiness, because Bhikkhu Anālaya's experience has been you can experience emptiness, complete emptiness, nirvana, by practicing the Brahma Viharas. Emptiness means there's no greed, hatred, or delusion. It means you are happy, you are free, and it's possible. And I started thinking about that because when we are not free, we are engaged in conceit. What's the definition of conceit? Anybody have, what do you think the definition of conceit is? Mm-hmm. That's right. Any preoccupation with self. So I think a standard American definition would be, you know, an inflated sense of ego. You know, that's not the way it is in Buddhist practice. Nikos is right. It's being obsessed with self. I had a wonderful occasion to travel to Burma 6 years ago, I think, now, and Joseph Goldstein was the teacher on this pilgrimage. And I spoke to him about some issues, and I said in I think, a very proud way. You know, I have a real difficult time doing metta for myself. I just don't think highly of myself. And I think there was a real pride in that, too, because it sounds humble. It sounds humble if you don't like yourself. And I think that was there. And he went, well, that's conceited. I went, what? No, I'm humble. No, that's conceited. And this whole thing was backfiring on me. And he said, any obsession with self is conceit. It's when you give up that obsession with self and connect with all other beings, you're free. That's exactly what Analia says here. There was a wonderful, I brought it because I wanted to read it to you, this book I'm reading right now by Bhikkhu Bodhi. He goes into this and how we can work with both wisdom and compassion. Okay, here's what he says. Loving kindness and right mindfulness. I will protect myself. Thus should the establishment of mindfulness be practiced. I will protect others. Thus should the establishment of mindfulness be practiced. Protecting oneself, one protects others. Protecting others, one protects oneself. And how is it, monks, that by protecting oneself, one protects others? By the pursuit, development, and cultivation of the four establishments of mindfulness. And how is it, monks, that by protecting others, one protects oneself? By patience, harmlessness, loving kindness, and sympathy. It is such a way that protecting others, one protects oneself. So this is the interconnectedness, you know, not about me, not about you, but it's us. Any of you went to the Women's March yesterday? Raise your hand if you went to the Women's March. Oh, great. I thought of this, and it was so wonderful on so many levels, but especially how kind people were to each other. And I'm sure you could, well, if I wasn't talking about this, I'd just ask you to all tell your stories about it, but you know, I went past some Muslim women, a little bit of Arabic I knew, assalamu alaikum, and they were just, oh, alaikum assalam, and it just felt so good to be able to connect with somebody. A woman was passing out cookies to everybody in our little group, and there weren't many, so they were breaking them into small pieces. So it was almost like if you were Catholic and having communion, you know, it was wonderful. My friend Terry, that I went with, she's got a knee that's got to be operated on, was struggling up some steps, and an African-American woman went over and covered her with her big quilt and said, sit with me. Sit down right next to me. I mean, it was, talk about metta, you know, just metta on top of metta. It was wonderful. So I was telling some of you, you know, while it's very sad in the situation we're in, it was also wonderful seeing people galvanized and really looking at what's important and acting on it. So it, I was inspired by it. Okay, so back to this. In order to practice the Brahmaviharas, in order to go on retreat, in order to really be serious about this practice, we also have to know when we're off track. And I think for many of us, that might be the hardest thing to do. We don't know when we're off track. We're so used to doing things in a certain way that we don't really think about, what am I doing? What is going on? Okay, now this is where it gets a little weird again. Now I'm going to bring up Leonard Cohen. But I love Leonard Cohen. He died on November 7th of 2016, 2 days before the election. And one of the reasons, and I gave a talk over at Sacramento Insight Meditation, I guess not over here at Sacramento Insight Meditation when I was sitting here, still used to saying that, and talked about Leonard Cohen and the Dharma. And one of the reasons I really, really appreciate him was what I had just said. Do we know when we are getting off track? He did. He really knew it. In fact, he called it the human predicament. And he was in the midst of the human predicament. He had a lot of depression in his life. He wrote, and somebody said, if you went to a Leonard Cohen concert, they should pass out razor blades to slit your wrist. I like melancholy, but he struggled. He did it all wrong, and he wrote about it, which I think was his brilliance. And I think so many of us could identify with the struggles that he had. That he was so honest about. And he was a spiritual seeker, you know. He was brought up Jewish, but he investigated mystical Christianity and Scientology and Buddhism and anything and everything. He just wanted to know it all. What were the answers? And he eventually became a Zen monk and spent 4 years out on Mount Baldy as a Zen monk, mostly in silence. In fact, his Zen name meant ordinary silence, which is kind of a funny name for someone who, you know, wrote such incredible poetry and songs. And he wrote during that time about sex, drugs, poetry, singing. Was one of the things I gave myself. Did I bring it? Yeah, I did. He wrote this right after he came off of Mount Baldy, a book of longing. I think it's brilliant. And the poetry is brilliant. One of his final albums, well, to back up, he spent 4 years on Mount Baldy, and then he went to India for another year. And when he went to India, I think he woke up. The 4 years on Mount Baldy and then India. I think I can get it.
One other little thing we can do is take the weight off.
Oh, thank you. So when he went to Mount Baldy and then he went to India, and he said the depression that had plagued him all his life had left. And he was happy, and he was grateful. And he also, I think, wrote his finest album. It was published just a few months before he died. It's called You Want It Darker. It's dark. It is so brilliant, but it is absolutely, I think, phenomenal. So I'm going to quote you one state. He really looked at where was he going wrong? What was happening? He looked at it intensely, and he didn't sugarcoat it. So this is just two stanzas from one of his songs on You Want It Darker. It's called On the Level. And he wrote this when he was on Mount Baldy as a Zen priest. Now I'm living in this temple where they tell you what to do. I'm old and I've had to settle on a different point of view. I was fighting with temptation, but I didn't want to win. A man like me don't like to see temptation caving in. That's brilliant. That just describes so many of us. How often have we just know this is what we should be doing, but I don't want to. I'm going to go for it and feel guilty about it. He wrote about it. He also, I listened to quite a few of his final interviews, actually his very last one, and I'm going to quote something he said. I am suspicious of holy men and their charisma. My conviction is what I feel is what more or less everybody feels. In meditation, things that arise are very disturbing. You have to sit in the bonfire of distress until it turns to ashes and is gone. Same with writing, a sense of unbearable disorder that drives you to take whatever you've got, a few things. It's the opposite of luxury. Something you can inhabit that changes your heart and mind. poetry is the ashes of our experience. So his very last poem, which never got interpreted into a song, I think is my favorite. Very simple. Listen to the hummingbird whose wings you cannot see. Listen to the hummingbird. Don't listen to me. Listen to the butterfly whose day's but number three. Listen to the butterfly. Don't listen to me. Listen to the mind of God, which doesn't need to be. Listen to the mind of God. Don't listen to me. So that was his last poet that maybe his son will turn into a song. So I think that's it for me. It's 10 minutes to 9. If you have any questions about solo retreats, Brahmaviharas, anything, I'm happy to answer them. Or, no, probably can't answer them, but do my best to answer them. Yes.
On your solo retreat, how do you control the environment that would intervene? It seems like it would be difficult to keep from being interrupted.
Yeah.
Especially if you're checking like emails.
I don't check emails. I did check text messages. I have my youngest son is a PhD biologist and has a nonprofit in Africa, and he was in Africa at the time. And so I was checking text messages to make sure everything was okay and he was going to get home all right, but I did not check emails. I did not use a computer. One time. And I create rules for myself. Susan and I have talked had many long talks about this. And I create an itinerary that I stick to rigidly for the first 3 or 4 days. And then let me back up. If you haven't done maybe 10 years of retreats, I wouldn't advise doing a solo retreat. You really need to have the discipline to do it. It's not easy. But once you establish a curriculum, literally what you're going to do every hour of the day, after about 4 or 5 days, for me, it starts to fall away, and I just start sitting organically and walking organically. I no longer am looking for a way to get out of it. Like, I shouldn't be doing this. Why don't I go watch a movie? Why don't I do this or that? I mean, all of that comes up. I want to talk to a friend or whatever, and you just have to stick to the schedule. And then it becomes very easy. But as far as food, I have a lot of frozen food, a lot of brown rice, a lot of oatmeal. In the past, I've walked to Trader Joe's. It's not far from my house. I take one grocery bag. I walk. I can put fresh produce in it and walk back again. And that's it. And that pretty much takes care of it. Yeah, I'll say hi to somebody if they say hi, but, you know, I don't engage in conversation. Does that answer it? Okay, thanks. Yeah.
How many days is your retreat?
This last one, which is really only half a retreat because I was only sitting in the mornings, last year it was 5 weeks. Yeah. But the very first one I did was a week, and I was really struggling for the first 3 days. Just like many of you who go on residential retreats, you might have a lot of fatigue or body ache. I had all of that, just like going away. And so my very first solo retreat, I had a teacher on call that I could talk to, which I did. I called him and said, I really need to talk to you because this isn't working out for me. And he said, yes, it is. This is exactly what happens on retreat. Remember? Oh, yeah. That's right. Yeah. Yes.
You brought up your trip to Burma and the discussion with Goldstein. In labeling your struggles with practicing self-compassion as conceit. Can you talk a little bit about that or how and when or how you turned a corner on that, got better at that?
Well, his comment was really helpful. I mean, talk about somebody just waking you up almost instantly on what you're doing wrong. That did it. Because I really felt I think I was proud of my self-loathing. I think this is the way we should be. I thought that. And it really was an obsession with self, which is, was keeping me in a state of suffering. It's not like I've gotten completely over that, but when I said, do we see what we're doing? Do we really see what we're doing? In that case, that woke me up to, yeah, you're just going into this whole narcissistic bag about self-loathing, and it's not doing one bit of good. You're not looking at anybody else except yourself. That's what I needed to hear. So, yeah, when I start getting into that place, I just remember that, well, that's conceited. And, oh, yeah, that's right. This is a stupid thing to do. So, yes.
So I'm with you, and I was just wondering, I've heard some comments here since I've been here, and I was just wondering if I work for Sacramento County on a psychotherapist, and I've become accustomed to interacting with people that with whom I have political views of the opposite end of the stick. Mm-hmm. So you were mentioning how you know when you're on track or not, and there's, I forget what the third term was, of compassion. If I would need you as a mentor, or I would want to attend a retreat, would you be capable of meeting me halfway, transcending, being able to teach somebody who, with whom you have a political views that do you have a burden to? I'm just wondering if that's also the thing, how you know when you're on track and the compassion. And I'm so used to doing that.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, would you be capable of allowing me to learn from you if I were able to do that, even though my beliefs might be deplorable to you. So, I mean, I don't know if I worded that correctly, but it seems to totally fit with mm-hmm. about the entire time here today, and I'm just not sure how to approach that.
I think we're all a work in progress, and what you just said is what we should all be working on, you know, all the time, as we are continually constantly running into things. We don't want it that way. That, you know, it's the point of my whole talk. I didn't want my retreat like this. I didn't want to deal with an addicted person when I was supposed to be in bliss. Yeah, don't want to deal with somebody who doesn't agree with me politically. That's the practice.
Even if somebody wants to learn from you.
I think that's wonderful. You know, it's not what we say, it's what we do. It's how we act. You know, we're all tossing around words all over the place. I know I certainly am. But it's how we respond and how we are with people. That's really the bottom line. It's so easy to toss around words that are so painful. I could love to give a long talk on right speech because that's one of my favorite topics. But no, it's what we do, how we respond. Thank you. Yes.
I was wondering if this might be very silly answer, but I would say it anyway. When you were talking about that person who lived 100 years to prevent the others to deal with the karma that they caused, I wonder if it is okay if that particular person, I'm sure that one was very selfless, but if it was me, the only way that I could convince myself to do such a thing would be that, knowing that it would cause a bad karma for me if I don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So is there, you know, is there a reason not to think that? Or because my personal view is that the only thing, when I feel I've been done wrong, and it's just, I won't wish that person wrong, or bad, or I just close my eyes on it and think that the universe will do, take care of it. It's actually considering that karma they're going to be dealing with. So how that works, I mean, how is it written in the sense that one karma, if I deal with preventing it, would it benefit me, or, you know, like that would be my reason to convince not being able to be that selfless as someone that hard.
Well, I think Venerable Xu Yun was an enlightened man, and so he went beyond any self-interest. His only concern was for others, and he didn't want them to suffer. His own suffering and his own intellectualism was not part of it. He wanted to make sure that these people who he has interacted with do not suffer because of their actions. The Buddha actually, in his teachings on metta, and it's pretty gruesome what he says. He said, you should have a mind that is so sublime and so at ease that as a bandit is sawing off your arm, you're wishing him loving kindness. That's what's in the suttas. And Xu Yun did that. He managed to do that. That is a mind that is beyond my comprehension. And I think for most of us, it's beyond our comprehension. But apparently it can be done because a fairly contemporary person did it and wanted to live so these people would have the chance to atone for what they did to him. It's remarkable. Thank you. Okay. All right. Thank you very much.